Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Vancor Insurance and Rex LeSure have been saving wildland fire contractors, caterers, and support crews up to 37% off the cost of their insurance. Don't take our word for it. Go to our website at www.wildlandfirecontractor.com and hear what our customers have to say. Start saving money on your insurance today. Call Rex at 800-452-6826.
Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. We are live at Firehouse World. Today we're going to have an introduction to wildland firefighting operations, looking at some of the basics in West Coast wildland operations and moving on to situation awareness for the wildland and wildland urban interface operations. We have three guests today, Quinn McLeod, Patrick Shanley, and Don Stuckey. Guys, thank you very much for joining me. And can we just get a little bit of a background and biography from each of you? Quinn?
Yeah, thanks, Pete. Quinn McLeod and I spent 20 years with the Parker Fire Protection District in South Denver. I left there a couple years ago to pursue training opportunities, which I'm now involved in. And then during the summer, I still go out as division supervisor.
Okay. And Patrick Shanley.
My name is Pat Shanley. I'm a retired battalion chief from Los Angeles City Fire Department. I was on an incident management team, a resource unit leader, and have done fatality investigations and burnover investigations, such as the Calabasas fire and a couple of burnovers for LA City engines, and instructed wildland firefighting for Los Angeles City for the last decade.
Okay, thank you. And Don Stuckey.
My name, again, is Don Stuckey. Also a retired battalion chief from LA City Fire, did 30 years there. Following my retirement, I've stayed involved with the fire service through consulting, teaching, and also I'm a red-carded structure protection specialist and safety officer, too, and I still respond to the incident management team-type fires in the summertime.
Okay, General, thank you for joining me. And I guess before we get going, we'll get into a little bit of the background of what you guys experience out here in California. One of the terms that we always hear is the red flag. So can you tell me a little bit about what a red flag condition means to the firefighters starting their shift in the morning at the firehouse?
I think that in general, the significance of a red flag day, it's usually characterized by high wind speed, low humidity, and a high temperature. And the combination of those three, depending on where you are in the state and the time of year, has a huge impact on what the wildland fire situation could be. In the research I've done in Southern California, I am not aware of a significant urban conflagration from a wildland fire that did not start on a red flag day. The correlation is very high. So the implications for a fire department or for a individual firefighter when a red flag day occurs, and I'm speaking of Southern California, but it can probably generalize to most of the state, if not the nation, there should be some very significant steps taken by a department and an individual when those days occur.
Yeah, if I could just jump in here, in Southern California in particular, and again, like Pat says, I think probably across the West now, when a red flag is declared in a given area, the news media has picked up on it, and they broadcast that to the citizens. And the good news is that the citizens are now, at least if you live in these types of areas, are becoming aware of what a red flag day means because the news media has picked up on it. And there are certain steps within the fire service that occur, and also even in the civilian sector, i.e. in the Hollywood Hills in the city of Los Angeles, on a high hazard day, on a red flag day, They have signs there that on a high hazard day, you cannot park on this street. And if you park here, your vehicle will be towed because it's such a narrow street that if there was a fire, it would impede the fire service getting in there to make a difference, and also the people trying to get out.
Okay. So.
You know, actually coming from out of state, you know, when we come to California and we know that they're in red flag warning, that makes a big difference in how we mentally prepare ourselves for when we get, you know, assigned to an incident here in California. So we know that, you know, the red flag days are going to be the days that, you know, all bets are off, and you got to be at the top of your game.
On the subject of red flag, once more, and I'll use the city of Los Angeles as an example because I'm most familiar, but that's fairly typical. A number of things occur. One is Chief Stuckey talked about, you'll have announcements to the public. Two, you'll have steps such as no parking. Three, agencies usually staff additional resources. They will staff specialized resources, such as additional helicopters and or bulldozers. Four, they may activate community fire patrols and things like that. Five, they will augment the dispatch to a reported wildland fire. And six, they may move resources from metropolitan areas out to areas that are more traditionally threatened by a wildland fire. So a whole number of steps can be taken by an agency and by an individual on a red flag day. And in, again, I'll use the city of Los Angeles, 456 square miles, and yet the number of red flag days in the city of Los Angeles is just a handful, 5, 6, 7 days a year. So you need to have your game face on, at least as far as the city goes, for just a handful of days where the risk of wildland fire is much higher than normal.
And when the incidents actually occur, you know, watching it from the Midwest on CNN, you'll see companies from not only the northern part of the state being in Southern California, but units from Nevada and other states. So how does the mutual aid process work? How do you call for the task force, and how are they made up, and how do you deal with units from other parts of the country that come in?
If I could jump in here, before the mutual aid, the big mutual aid machine gets into motion, we have what we call the IAZ, the Initial Action Zone. And certainly, like Pat just mentioned, it changes. One of the things is it changes our whole dispatch system to we throw everything but the kitchen sink at that fire initially, because we want to jump on it and try and contain it before it gets to be this conflagration. Our neighboring agencies, LA County, the Forest Service, Ventura County, we have areas that are like a gray zone between the jurisdictions, or includes parts of each jurisdiction, where all of these agencies, sometimes we'll get four agencies responding to one dispatch, and the number of resources that we throw at it is on purpose to try and get a handle on it before it gets away from us. And it is a challenge when you're the first in battalion chief and you have more resources coming at you than probably half or better of the cities in the whole nation have on duty at any given time. So we really try and jump on it hard. And that's the start of the mutual aid. It's automatic aid. It's IAZ, the Initial Action Zone. Okay. So that's the start of the campaign, if that's what it ends up being.
As an example, there'll be places around the periphery of the city of Los Angeles that Chief Stuckey talked about, and on an initial dispatch to a reported brush fire in an initial action zone, you could get up to 250 firefighters on that initial reported dispatch under certain conditions. Generally, though, mutual aid within the city of within the state of California, it's gone back into the 1950s. There's a series of agreements that the state has a mutual aid system. There are regional coordination centers for each Office of Emergency Services region within the state, and then there's an also interplay with within federal agencies and the local ones, and there are also local agreements between cities that occur. So it's a mosaic of agreements. There are financial implications also, but the overall pattern is generally central and Northern California, their fire season is in middle summer, late spring, and you'll tend to see the resources from the south of the state moving north for their fires. And when fire season peaks in Southern California, usually is in the fall and winter, and that's when the Central and Northern California resources tend to reciprocate and end up coming south to assist with the large fires in the southern area.
Okay.
The bottom line with the mutual aid is it really when FireScope started in the early 1970s, and it really got on board about that time when all those things were happening. And truly, the bottom line is, if someone in almost any part of the state has a major incident, and they say, "Give me 200 or 300 engines," in a lot of parts of the country, they're going to say, "You want what?" Here, it's almost to the point of being routine, and they can make that happen and have those resources on scene within 8 hours or less. So it's a massive system, but it does work, and thank goodness it works with the types of fires we have down here.
Okay, and then it is a red flag day, and you've been alerted to a fire in the wildland environment. Situation awareness, you hear that a lot for the structural firefighters. What is situation awareness for folks in a wildland or the wildland-urban interface environments? What do companies and incident commanders need to know when they're getting on scene? What are they looking for? What are hints that that you know potential hazards are around the corner?
You want to start that, Quinn?
Well, situational awareness is really the the first step in, you know, your decision-making process, and more importantly, it's first step in identifying those hazards and then mitigating those hazards. And good situational awareness starts out with trying to paint yourself an actual picture of really what you're looking at. So it starts out with a perception of what you see, and then you build on it with you know, either new information that's communicated to you or observations that you view out there. The important thing about situational awareness is being able to really decipher what you're seeing out there and making sure that it is truly reality. We talked about that quite a bit, Don and I.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, some of the phrases that are used in the fire service, guys throw things out like, make sure you got your LCES, make sure you got your situational awareness. And for some guys, that really means something, and you can tell the way they say it and the look in their eyes that they've got it. Some guys say it because they think they need to or they're checking off a box. And to me, situational awareness, and for the folks that are listening that are involved in wildland firefighting, we're all supposed to have our field pocket guide in our Nomex shirt at all times. And in there, there's this decision-making process, risk process, and the first thing in there is situational awareness. And it's got about six different things that you should consider. And to me, that really leaves me flat. To me, situational awareness is it's an ongoing process throughout the day. And if I'm going to work on a red flag day, when I step out of my house at 5:30 in the morning, and it's nice and balmy and maybe even hot already, and the wind's blowing, and it's super dry, You know, your lips are already chapped because the weather's so dry, and you know the humidity is about 5% at 6:30 in the morning. That's the start of your situational awareness. And who are you working with that day? And where are you working? And you need to take all of these pieces to the puzzle, I like to phrase it, and they're numerous. And it would be a good idea for everybody to sit down and write out what the pieces are. And everybody's going to come up with different pieces, but the point is to put these pieces together to paint this picture, and that's what's going to lead you to making the right decisions that day.
Yeah, Don brought up, knowing, some of the people that you're working with is also part of situational awareness, because that human element out there ends up becoming a bigger and bigger factor. So situational awareness is not only the fire environment that you're involved in, it's also the human element, the people that you're working with, all kinds of little different indicators of how their day is going. Because when it comes right down to making decisions, it doesn't matter what rank you're at, everybody's making decisions. And having a higher level of situational awareness, whether it's the fire environment or the people you're working with, is going to lead to those better decisions.
In structural firefighting, the research shows firefighters tend to make decisions based on recognition prime decision making. It's almost an intuitive subconscious process. I think for the wildland environment, situational awareness has to be a conscious process, and it's a much more dynamic thing where you've got to search out some of the items that have just been talked about to have an accurate picture and stay safe.
I said it'd be a good kitchen drill in a firehouse for everybody to write down the factors or the situational conditions is what I like, because that leads you to the situational awareness if you know the situational conditions. And just to mention some of them, attitude of leaders, attitude of crew. Is a crew solid in the tasks that they carry out day to day? Are they a working team like we should be? Are you working with people that you haven't worked with for 6 months, or maybe you've never worked with them before? What's their experience level? Is the attitude of the crew or the leader too macho for their own good? And you're coming in and you're working with guys that have this this macho air to them, and you're going, ooh, I'm not getting a real warm, fuzzy feeling here. Injuries. And if you're on the fire ground, it's like Murphy's Law. Everything's going great. You got all these things tuned in, and now you get distractions. You know, you're well involved. You got your eye on the ball. You're fighting this fire. You've got this nice overview, and a distraction comes along. I.e., let's say that you've got your crew going, or you've got your strike team going, and one of the strike team engines just calls you and says, hey, we've just dropped our drive line. Okay, my first thought as a strike team leader is, where are they and are they in danger? A member of a crew sprains an ankle, and you've estimated what your trigger point to get out of a certain location is, and now you've got a guy with a sprained ankle. That's all, to me, part of that changing situational awareness of what am I up against.
Yeah, Pat brings up a good thought about all the RPD studies that were done. And, RPD is recognition prime decision making as, something that has been identified that firefighters rely on a lot. And I think we're under the perception that in the future, it's a good idea if we take RPD, can possibly narrow us down to a narrower field of choices. And then being able to weigh those choices, especially in wildland firefighting, with conjunction with what situational awareness actually is, what is the situation, is going to lead us to those better decisions. So, not going so much off your gut, not going so much off what you did in the past that did happen to work, because of all these changing factors out there, it really is better at the time to be able to analyze that a little bit more, take the time.
You just said something that kind of triggered me, and what's happened in the past, and you get back to that crew. Has the crew done the same risky operation before, and they got away with it. They were successful with it. Now that tends, in the mindset, that tends to make that okay. And I always kind of worry about that. You know, it's just one of those psychological things, I guess, that you wonder, okay, if you dodge the bullet enough times, does that become routine? And in our business, that can be real dangerous.
Mm-hmm. That also ends up kind of falling down that denial road, too. You know, you deny that it was a risky operation and that the gain was worth it.
Yeah.
And like you're saying, you know, if you dodge that bullet enough, that becomes commonplace. And that's one of those, attitudes that you need to throw into your, you know, situational awareness to make sure that that's, you know. And one other thing I always thought about, too, was how about the companies that say, well, it's a red flag day, but you know what? We never get any wildland fires over here. And, we have climatic change going on no matter how you view it's created. So we're getting historic fires everywhere. And, that's something that an attitude that does need to change is that it can happen literally anywhere. And that is something that we need to be thinking about also. If you're thinking that it won't happen to you, then immediately your situational awareness is low because you aren't respecting what the environment is throwing at you right from the very first time you walk out the door of your house to go to work.
I think that it can't happen to you is a good comment because I was a member of the LA City Fire Department for 34 years, and I would say in that time, the number of wildland fires that Los Angeles City responded to and the size of them is just the trend in California and I think nationally has been for the number and severity of these fires to increase. So the likelihood that someone sitting on a metropolitan engine on a beach city ending up in the middle of a wind-driven fire on a red flag day, it just increases every year.
Okay. Now the other thing, like you say, especially with the mutual aid system here in the Western United States, and certainly in California, you can be sitting anywhere, and the next thing you know, you're going down the road to someplace maybe you've never been before. And if that leads me to the thought process of if I hear of a fire somewhere and I'm on duty, you might want to think about getting Google Earth on your little computer. And bring up that location where the fire is and print an overview so that at least you can see what you're, if you go, you kind of know what you're getting into and you can discuss it around the kitchen table with your crew and maybe that's the start of your operation before the bell ever goes off.
Okay. That's a great training point. So now you have your pieces of the puzzle, what affects your situational awareness. How does that affect the incident commander or the command staff for an incident and even the strike force or the strike team companies? What do they take into play as far as their command decision-making with the conditions that are out there, with what the fire is doing and whatnot?
Well, let's paint a scenario that you are now part of a strike team, and I'll put myself in the position of being the strike team leader, and I get these resources. Hopefully, the best of all worlds is that I get five engines. And for the folks out there that don't know what a strike team is, it's five like resources. So it would be if you're a Type 1 strike team, you'd have five Type 1 engines. If it's a Type 3 strike team, you'd have five Type 3 engines. So the best of all worlds is that I get those five engines all from the same jurisdiction, hopefully my jurisdiction. And in LA City, that would be the case because we have the resources to do it. But other smaller jurisdictions in a given area, they may all send one engine. So you may have five different agencies, five different engines, and you're the strike team leader. That could or that may or may not be an issue for you or a concern for you, but it should certainly be part of your thought process and your situational awareness. So first thing I'm going to do as a strike team leader, when we assemble, wherever we're told to assemble and head out towards wherever the fire is that initial briefing. And I'm not going to take things haphazardly. I'm going to use that pocket guide, that IRPG, and I'm going to get out on the back of that is a layout of a typical briefing, and go line by line and discuss with everybody, not just the captains. When I give that initial briefing, there's going to be some briefings where all I want is those five captains and myself being there. But when that strike team first forms up, I want all 20-some people standing in front of me so that we're all on the same page. And that's where it starts.
Okay. Yeah, that's a great point because, it's the subtlest thing that will get by the true decision makers, you know, those of us at the top of the food chain that are trying to make all these decisions with all these distractions, all these other stressors that are out there. Well, we can't capture it all. And sometimes when you have your five, supervisors there, you know, sometimes things will get by us also. So by being able to include everybody in as many of those briefings as you possibly can, now at a certain point you're going to get a saturation where you aren't going to be able to converse with everybody. And then, you know, that's just a known. But boy, if you can get as many people's SA, their situational awareness, up as high as possible by including them in those briefings, it just helps at the command level to make such better decisions.
Wildland Fire Contractors, caterers, and support crews, you're in a specialty business and you need to work with someone who understands your business. Bancor Insurance is a specialty insurance agency and we specialize in insuring wildland fire contractors, caterers, and support crews. Don't take my word for it. Go to our website at www.wildlandfirecontractor.com and hear what our customers have to say. You could save as much as 37% off the cost of your insurance today. Call Rex at 800-452-6826.
You know, I had a comment, if we could roll on that command thing a little bit, is, and I know in Southern California, you're really big into like apparatus, true strike teams. Now, when you venture out of Southern California, that system can then, you know, change, and then you start getting more of the task force configuration. Now, I've heard comments from a lot of people in Southern California system that end up going out on campaign fires throughout the West about the benefit of those task force organizations, you know, having different types of engines with different capabilities, having a water tender assigned to your task force, and now the new capability that you now have. The interesting thing is that if you aren't used to working in a task force configuration, it ends up being just not a wasted resource by any means, but the learning curve, if you aren't used to working in that world, all of a sudden takes the commander and puts them below the waterline a little bit to where they have to struggle to, you know, figure out what the capability is of everybody. But that's something that, I don't know is ever visited by Southern California, but a task force configuration for those of us that work in other parts is definitely pretty handy.
Yeah. Yeah, and for the folks that may not know the difference between a strike team and a task force is just what it sounds like. It's a grouping of resources to complete a task. An example, as a safety officer too, I found myself in Texas, I think it was in 03, whenever all of Texas was burning up, and that's the way we ran in Texas. And for example, with the types of fires they were having, they formed up task forces with two or three engines, a water tender, and a dozer, or a plow. And that was our task force, and it worked very well for the type of incidences we were responding to. And you get into that, and part of when you actually get on scene of an incident, and part of your briefing, and part of your as, certainly as the the task force leader, you're going to always want to be aware of what trigger point is to get out of Dodge. If things really start going bad, you need to have that established trigger point where you're going to say, okay, guys, we've reached our trigger point. Let's get out of here. That should be a trigger point that gets everybody out of there safely. And in the situation with a task force, remember I said now you've got a dozer with a transport that's not going to be able to move nearly as quick as a fire engine or a patrol rig or anything else. So when you're talking about your trigger points in a task force configuration where you got some of everything, you need to time it so that that slowest component safely gets out of harm's way and you don't lose your visibility. Maybe the fire's not there yet, but what if you end up with zero visibility and you got a guy driving a dozer transport? Now you've got a problem.
Yeah, Pete, that's one of those learning curves that I was kind of talking about. If you aren't used to working in a task force configuration, all of a sudden you've got a dozer thrown in there. That's some serious issues that come up there. A handy thing about the task force configuration is that if you marry up a smaller piece of equipment with a larger piece of equipment, i.e. like a patrol rig or a Type 3 with a Type 1 engine, then now they have the ability to actually do a little more scouting, which ultimately raises their SA up and allows them to, plan for those hazards that they're going to encounter, put lookouts in the right spots and establish escape routes, safety zones, and that type of stuff. So the task force is really pretty handy. It really depends on where you're at, though, as to whether it can be configured.
One other task force or strike team issue you might encounter, not so much in Southern California, but probably the Northwest, is you might have a strike team or task force made up of private fire protection people who are not government employees, who may be truly part-time firefighters and might require some significant supervisory challenges on the part of the strike team leader or task force leader.
Yeah, and it's not to say they aren't good firefighters, but some of those agencies or those companies, that's the way they make money. And so sometimes, just getting folks assigned to fires is what keeps the business afloat. Another interesting point that Pat's also bringing up is that a common theme in those areas, and we see that in California last year too with the historic year that California had in the middle of the summer, but contractors will bring in, they'll rotate crew members out one at a time. Well, so what do you think the situational awareness is of that crew? It's lower, obviously, because they've got a new member in. And, not everybody gets along. So that can also degrade the essay. So yeah, contract resources are interesting. Good hands, but they definitely come with their challenges.
Yeah, I remember, it's interesting you mentioned that. I was, I was there as a safety officer, but they realized that I was from Southern California, so they put me in the area of the fire where there was a lot of structures threatened, and they says, well, why don't you just kind of wear two hats and be the structure protection guy and also be the safety officer. So I said, okay, well, what resources do we have down there and what's my real estate? What am I responsible for? And they says, well, you've got 30 engines. And I said, oh, that's pretty good. And my mindset from California, having a mindset of California resources, I'm thinking, oh, cool, I got 30 engines down there. Well, when I got down there, it ran the full gamut. I had a Type 1 engine, I remember, from Missoula. And I had, on the other end of the spectrum, I had a pickup truck with 100 gallons of water with the 50 GPM jockey pump on it with two 18-year-old kids, their first fire season. So know what you have as far as resources and put them in the places where you're warm and fuzzy with their location when that fire comes. It was a different assignment.
All right. Well, gentlemen, if there's any closing comments, if not, I'd just like to thank you for joining me today. Again, we have Quinn McLeod, Patrick Shanley, and Don Stuckey. Patrick and Don are from L.A. City, and Quinn's from Parker, Colorado. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me on this podcast, and we look forward to doing some more work with you in the future.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Pete.
Thank you.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.